This is Reaganism, a podcast dedicated to exploring where the Reagan movement lives today. I'm Roger Zach. I'm your host, director of the Ronald Reagan Institute in Washington, D.C.
On this episode of Reaganism, Roger sits down with former member of Congress, the Honorable David Dreyer, who now serves as the chairman of the Fallen Journalists Memorial Foundation. They discuss Representative Dreyer's work in founding and leading the new Fallen Journalists Memorial Foundation, which seeks to construct a permanent memorial on the National Mall to honor fallen journalists. They also look back at Representative Dreyer's time serving in Congress, in particular during the Reagan administration, and what it was like working directly with President Reagan.
David Dreyer, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Roger. It's a thrill to be with you. And I will say that you're always a very dapper guy. And I got into my suit and tie for you, remembering very vividly how Ronald Reagan's assistant, Michael Deaver, one day was going into the Oval Office after it had been hot out in the Rose Garden. And he threw his coat on the couch, and he asked President Reagan why he didn't take his coat off. And he said, well, I have so much respect for this this room that I will do that. So I'm having a similar feeling towards you as I do this. And I want to say that as we begin this discussion, I just want to say how much I've appreciated your amazing service, your leadership at the House Armed Services Committee with my former colleague, Buck McKeon. And I always, as I was chairing the Rules Committee, was happy to look out and see your smiling face, and I knew that we would have a brilliant work product, even though we'd probably make in order 150 amendments to the Defense Authorization Act. I always appreciated the fact that you were there doing such a great job.
Well, I thank you for that, and you're always my chairman of the Rules Committee, no matter who's the chair of the Rules Committee. And those 150 amendments to me was just a testament to the fact that there's no perfection in life.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. You know, I only did that job for 14 years. We had 6-year term limits for committee chairs, and I kept trying to leave, and I ended up staying longer than I had planned. I was either the chairman or the ranking member for 14 years, but we can get into that later. But let me just also at the outset express appreciation to not only to you, but to Fred Ryan and Dave Trulio and of course, you know, his predecessor, my friend John Highbush, who worked on Capitol Hill as well. And then of course Anthony Eames, who brought us together in August for the largest gathering of scholars at any presidential library ever. And so you all are doing very great and important things. My friend Bob Cochran, who, of course, had worked for Buck as well. So many people there that you have done such very important work. And from my perspective, Roger, I will tell you that it's really more important than it ever has been.
Well, I want to get to that as well. And thank you. We're fortunate to... I'm fortunate to have a chance to work with you again now here at the Reagan Foundation Institute, and as we'll get into, of course, your relationship with Reagan was with the man, with the president, and excited for our viewers and listeners to hear about some of those memories and stories from your early days in the House of Representatives, and of course, as President Reagan moved from his second term, and you increased his seniority in the House of Representatives. But part of what I wanted to talk to you about today is not just about what you did in the Congress and your relationship with Ronald Reagan, but actually what happened after Congress. And you've done a number of interesting things. One in particular, you were a past chairman of the Tribune Publishing Company. And then now, of course, your association leading the Foreign Journalist Memorial Foundation, which I'd love for you to talk about, in particular, a monument that will go up on the Mall, which sounds to me like a terribly bureaucratic process, but one you've navigated successfully, another testament and accomplishment of yours. But that work, of course, you were involved in your years in the Congress, but really the focus now on freedom of the press and how you came about it. That's an amazing story, which I want our viewers and listeners to hear.
Well, Roger, first, let me just say that I really had spent my life, I spent a third of a century in the Congress, and so I was in my mid-20s until 10 years ago when I chose to leave myself. I always like to say I chose to leave because one of my former colleagues one time came down to the floor of the Congress and said, I left Congress for health reasons. The voters got sick of me. And I left by choice, I'm happy to say, a decade ago. And I wanted to leave while I was in my 50s. Lee Hamilton, who had been the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee and with whom I co-chaired the Joint Committee on the Organization of Congress in 1993, told me that I should leave while I was in my 50s so that I could have, another career beyond having, spent my life in the Congress. He told me, frankly, if I stayed, I'd end up like John Dingell, which I did not want to do. So, as much as I love John Dingell, it was not a priority for me to do that. So when I did, I made a decision. I used Cincinnatus, who in 356 BC, after his second reign as ruler of Rome, he said, I'm going back to the plow, back to the farm. And James Madison famously said, Roger, that you should serve and then go home and live with the laws that have been passed. And so I was actually, at that time, I was in the process of, I did interviews, potentially doing a show on Fox. Roger Ailes had me, and then Jeff Zucker, who was head of CNN, was talking to me about that. And I talked with Bob Barnett, who was a lawyer, that, you know, I was approached about an opportunities in Washington. And I decided to use Cincinnatus and James Madison as the model. So I literally, 10 years later, I have not set foot in the U.S. Capitol since I left 10 years ago. I have a great deal of reverence for the First Amendment. And, I believe that the people who are who choose to lobby can do that. But I've chosen not to. I said I preached entrepreneurship my whole life, so I decided to practice it. And so I've gotten into a number of different businesses. And one of the things, I'm working with about a half dozen startups now. In fact, I'm just getting ready to go on the board of a new startup that's based out here in California. But one of the things I felt strongly about, and people encouraged me not to go on too many, but I went onto one public company board, and I was approached by people from several different companies. I mean, Chevron, Gilead Sciences, Freeport-McMoRan, there were several of them. And I was really attracted to the media. My grandfather had actually been the business manager for the Daily Oklahoma newspaper 100 years ago. And so I figured I had it in my DNA. And of course, I'd spent my life in newsrooms and before editorial boards at newspapers across the country. And so when I found that the parent company, the Los Angeles Times, Tribune, which flagship paper is really the Chicago Tribune, 150 newspapers across the country, I was approached about becoming a director there, and so I did that, and found it just to be absolutely fascinating, very challenging, really, really difficult business, Roger. But clearly, in the 175-year history of Tribune, the worst day was June 28th of 2018, because a disgruntled reader who had been unhappy with reporting that that took place in the Capital Gazette in Annapolis, Maryland, went into the newsroom.
And the Capital Gazette, just to clarify, that is one of the papers of the constellation of papers that the Tribune owned, right? I mean, this was one.
We had 150 papers. And so it was, of course, it was one of the papers that we had. And so, so it was on my watch that this took place. It's the oldest newspaper in the country, first published in 1727, the Capital Gazette in Annapolis. And so, I mean, it's just, a very, very tragic irony how this came about, Roger. And so this guy went into the newsroom and he sprayed it and he killed five of the people who worked there. And as I said, it was the worst day in the history of Tribune to have this take place. So what happened was, I mean, it was just devastating. We had 6,000 employees at the company. And so I did not know these people at the time, but I've certainly gotten to know the family members since this very tragic event took place. And you'll recall that where you are right now, down the street, there was the museum, which was this right there on Pennsylvania Avenue, spectacular spot. Well, as you know very well, it went bankrupt. Mike Bloomberg bought the building and gave it to his alma mater, Johns Hopkins. And so the museum, as wonderful as it was, doesn't exist any longer. And I had these people who were killed in the newsroom of the Capital Gazette. And then To be very honest, I will tell you that I was less than happy when the President of the United States repeatedly said, journalists are the enemies of the people. And as anyone in public office will attest to, we all have difficulty with journalists. Ronald Reagan used to mix it up with Sam Donaldson and lots of other people. I regularly had encounters with journalists that were not all that great. But the First Amendment is so vitally important. I like to say that journalists are both an expression of, as well as the guardians of liberty. So I was in Washington at the Gridiron Dinner, and it was, you know, they were making kind of a to-do. I was there as a guest of Judy Woodruff and Al Hunt. I remember this, and people were joking that I went from the Republican leadership to becoming one of the enemies of the people, is what people were joking at that dinner to me about. So, you know, there I was as the chairman of Tribune. And I was flying back here to Los Angeles, and I thought about all of these factors, and I said, you know, there's really nothing on our national mall that recognizes the First Amendment and journalists who have died in pursuit of the truth. We have so many wonderful memorials there, but it's to me a very, very glaring example of a void that exists. I got off the plane and I picked up the phone and I called Don Graham, who has family, has a long history of the Washington Post, and Wallace Annenberg, my friend out here, and Michael Farrow, who was the largest shareholder of Tribune. And I mentioned to all of them, and they were all just euphoric. They said, yes, let's do it. Well, my old professor out in Claremont, Peter Drucker, was a management guru, very famously said, every brilliant idea ultimately devolves into nothing but hard work. And so you mentioned at the outset, Roger, there are 20, by one count, 23 different government agencies through which we have to go to make this happen. And so we put together a spectacular team.
Just to contextualize this a bit. So you have this idea, obviously you go to some barons of the world of media and journalism. They all think it's a great idea, validate. And you're going to take this on to put some form of monument or memorial on the mall dedicated to freedom of the press. And you made the point, it's not just that there hasn't been one like that. Actually, the Bill of Rights aren't in any way celebrated on the mall that I'm aware of, or remembered or memorialized. So it's not just freedom of the press, it's any other of freedoms. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right. I will tell you, the other day I was watching on MSNBC. I watched a little clip. They were talking about Floyd Abrams, and Ted Olson, who had been Solicitor General, came on and he said, the single most important item in the U.S. Constitution is the First Amendment. He said that. Actually, frankly, I disagree, and you will appreciate what I've always said. I've always said that the single most important words in the preamble of the Constitution.
That'd be we the people. We the people.
For the common defense.
Oh, that
that's why? Because that's the most important thing that the federal government has the responsibility of doing. You know, virtually everything else can be done by state and local governments. But those five words in the middle of the preamble of the Constitution, I used to always say that during debate on the House floor, is provide for the common defense. But Ted Olson mentioned in this interview the First Amendment, and you're right. I mean, there really is not recognition for the Bill of Rights. And Roger, we're the only nation in the world that actually has a First Amendment that guarantees those freedoms, the press freedoms that are there. So, as I say, you know, journalists are both an expression of as well as the guardians of liberty. And so I think that there was just this void that existed there. And, you know, I've got
void, and there was a tragedy, which is a reflection of a moment where we were as a nation where, because of that tragedy, people recognize, hey, whatever the rhetoric now is creating conditions where crazy people think they can exact violence against the people who express freedom of the press and practice it every day in the form of a journalist. And then how many agencies need to sign off on this? I mean, that just sounds impossible.
23. But anyway, it's a daunting and overwhelming task. And we've got this amazing woman who's the, like me, volunteer president of the foundation, Barbara Cochran, who was the executive producer of Meet the Press. She was a vice president of CBS. She worked originally at the Washington Star. She was National Public Radio. Her husband is John Cochran, who was a longtime reporter on NBC and ABC. And our team working closely with the people that you mentioned, these iconic people, Don Graham, the Annenbergs, and others, as I did this, they helped me find Barbara to do this. I have my former Rules Committee staff director, Vince Randazzo, is the project director for this. And so we have taken this on with a great deal of enthusiasm. We announced the formation of it one year after that tragic day. So it was June of 2019 that we announced it. And it is a multi-year project. And as you mentioned, with all these agencies through which we have to go to get this, the Commission on Fine Arts, the Park Service has been phenomenal. I mean, I will say that we just got an email in the last week, which basically was so complimentary of the way we've been able to do this, because many people, Roger, you know, have ideas and they want to put a memorial on the National Mall. But frankly, from what I've observed, we've gotten just about the last spot. We have the east entrance at the base of the U.S. Capitol, looking right up at the Capitol, a third of an acre that's ironically and interestingly and appropriately right across the street from the Voice of America. And they have the highest number of deaths of journalists in the world. You, of course, know where the Botanic Gardens is. Basically the intersection of
independent. So it's on the House side, looking up at the Capitol, right?
Correct. So it's the east entrance to the National Mall. So it's the intersection of Independence and Third Street, and there's a little stretch of Maryland, which symbolically is important because we all know how the Fourth Estate journalists are to be independent of the government. And so this is an island that is right there at Independence, Third, and Maryland. And one of the things I argue about journalism, but I argue that conservatives should actually embrace journalism, because what is it that journalists do? They challenge authority. They challenge power. They hold people's feet to the fire. And what is it that we as conservatives believe is the greatest threat? And that is the power of big, massive government, which, Thomas Jefferson and Madison both put this forward. I mean, you know, Jefferson had the most powerful inaugural address, March 3rd, 1801, when he said, "My fellow citizens, a wise and frugal government shall restrain men from injuring one another, and shall leave them otherwise free to regulate their own pursuits of industry and improvement, and shall not take from the mouth of labor the bread it has earned. This is the sum of good government." And so that's why I believe. And then, of course, Jefferson famously said, if given a choice of living in a country with government and no newspapers, or newspapers and no government, I choose the latter. And and then Madison had another one. And I learned this one when I walked in, one of the first times I walked into the Tribune Tower, which is this sanctuary in Chicago. And, you know, here I was walking into this Tribune Tower, which now actually they built condominiums above and they've got a new high-tech office. But the tower itself in this entry is being preserved. And I looked up and all these famous quotes were there. Voltaire's famous, "I disagree with everything you have to say, but I'll fight to the death for your right to say it." I thought I'd read everything Madison, because out here at Claremont, where I went to school, I had to memorize the 10th Federalist. I had the Federalist pounded into me. But I read this quote of Madison's, which was just really striking, Roger. Madison said, "To the press alone, checkered as it is with abuses, the world is indebted for all the triumphs that have been gained by reason and humanity over error and oppression." I mean, those are the words of the guy who is the author of the U.S. Constitution. See, I've committed those to memory because of this project, taking this on, looking back at what the framers had to say on it.
We're with David Dreyer, former congressman from California, chair and ranking member on the House Rules Committee, friend of the Reagans. and now leading this amazing project to put a monument on the mall by the Fallen Journalist Memorial Foundation. You know, I think the geography here is really important. And as you're describing this, I mean, you take a step back and you look at the genius, the design in Washington. People love to call it the swamp, but you think about the Congress, right? The People's House leading up on either side. It's guarded by the Constitution, Constitution Avenue, and the Independence Avenue, or Declaration of Independence. And that space between the Congress, the Capitol building, all the way down, of course, takes you looking at the Lincoln Memorial at the end, and in between the Washington Monument. And that's the design. That's kind of what guards the Republic, right? It guards the people. The people congregate in that mall, which can hold up to a million people. But they're looking up at the Capitol, where the elected officials are, and the guardrails are the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. And now we'll have this monument. Talk for a minute about the monument. Talk why a monument, not a memorial? Because of course, what triggered this, based on listening to your description earlier in this discussion, was a terrible tragedy in Annapolis. One of the papers that your company owned, but it's a monument. Explain that.
So before I do that, Roger, I want to ask you a question. How many people do you believe are on the National Mall every year?
Okay. Usually I'm the one who asks the questions here, but I'll play along. I'm going to say maybe there are 15 million people a year.
So it's 25 to 32 million people a year are on the National Mall, 25 to 32 million people a year. And that's why this is so vitally important to have the First Amendment and press freedoms and journalists recognized because of course, as we look at the tragic, the wars that we're dealing with right now in Ukraine and Israel, and I have to say that to you, Roger, the kind of anti-Semitism and the anti-Israel rhetoric that has been going on is just so, so disturbing for all of us to see. But we have more than a few. I mean, every day the number of journalists who've been killed seems to increase. And so it is important. So this actually is a memorial. What I'd said to you is the only monument there is actually the Washington Monument. And the reason is that it was authorized by the Congress before General Washington passed away. And so he was living. The rest are memorials. And so this is called the Fallen Journalist Memorial because this is about journalists who've died. But the thing that I want to recognize with the Fallen Journalist Memorial is the absolute importance of press freedoms as enshrined in the First Amendment, which, as I say, we're the only country that actually has this, these rights guaranteed. And so that's what it is. And I've learned all this, you know, over the last, two or three years as we've gone through this laborious process. I mentioned that I've not set foot in the Capitol, and I prided myself of having not made any requests of my former colleagues who serve in the Senate and the House. And this is the first time that I actually have. I went to my friends, Ben Cardin, who represented Maryland, still does represent Maryland in the Senate, and he's retiring now. And Rob Portman, my friend from Ohio, who, had a wide range of jobs, budget director, U.S. Trade Representative, and served in the Congress. And then I went in the House to Tom Cole, who now is a successor of mine as chairman of the House Rules Committee, and my California colleague, Grace Napolitano, from out here in Los Angeles, who chairs the subcommittee of the Interior Committee. It was called the Interior Natural Resources Committee, I guess it's called now. Actually, I'm the one who changed the names of them back in 1994. That was my job. I remember what Newt gave me. So I it's the Natural Resources Committee. So she chairs that subcommittee. And I went to those four members, and they introduced this when we announced it in July of 2019. And again, And interestingly enough, Roger, we were able to get this through both houses of Congress unanimously. And if you think about it, it's not that easy, because recognizing journalists especially is not always the most popular among people who think as you and I do, or at least, part of our political party. And so it is, you know, it was a tough thing to do to get it through unanimously. And we also were able to get Donald Trump's signature on it, which was a challenge because we have our board of advisors, which really spans the political spectrum. We have Chris Ruddy, Britt Hume, Brett Baer, Hugh Hewitt on our board, as well as people, you know, Tom Brokaw and Andrea Mitchell and Judy Woodruff and people
so covering the full spectrum there.
Yeah, across the spectrum. But
my recollection of your time in the Congress, I mean, here we're talking about your commitment to freedom of the press and what you're doing to make sure that our nation celebrates it, is educated, values it. And there's no better way to do that than having presence on the national mall, as we've discussed. But in addition to your role in leadership, you always were someone who took your time in the Congress to advance human freedom and democracy. In fact, there's a picture which our viewers and will have a chance to see from Peter Hanifer's book, Reagan's old aide, where it's a picture of you in 1988 in the Oval Office greeting an Afghan boy. It's you, the boy, and Ronald Reagan. It's of course one of what Reagan did in support of the Afghan people in countering Soviet aggression there in the 1980s, perhaps less well known, but was clearly you were a key player along with Charlie Wilson and others. I mean, the focus on freedom writ large, it was a big part of what Reagan emphasized and brought to office, and a big part of your tenure. Talking about freedom of press, but more broadly, human freedom.
Well, let me just first say that photograph that you have there of Hazrat Khan, who I met, we brought wounded Mujahideen to the United States for medical treatment. And this kid was 5 years old. He was walking to a friend's house, and a Soviet Hindi attack helicopter machine gunned him. His uncle put him on a mule, brought him to Peshawar, Pakistan, and he died. They revived him, and they told him he could never walk, and he did. And so Charlie Wilson and I met Hazrat and spent time with him, and he was this very precocious. He went to work for the U.S. government in very, very important areas. I mean, I'm not going to go beyond that. You understand, Roger, but he did that since he'd grown up. But He came with us, with Charlie and me, at a number of media appearances so that we could demonstrate what it was. And you can see in that picture, I'm actually handing President Reagan something that the Soviets did. It was called a butterfly bomb, and they would drop these toys to target kids. And this is kind of the similar thing that we're still dealing with today, unfortunately. They didn't want to kill the children, Roger. They wanted to wound them because they knew they would be a greater burden on their families and society if they were still alive but wounded. So this butterfly bomb that I was holding there. So that's an example. So obviously this really inspired us. And listen, I mean, obviously liberating the people from the Soviet Union was a very high priority. We can, you know, we could spend days going through the history of everything that's taken place since then and the challenges that we've had. But it still was the right thing for us to extricate the get the Soviets out of Afghanistan. And so, you know, I'm proud of that. So, you know, June 8th of 1982, and I know that you're going to ask, I was told you're going to ask me at the end, my favorite Reagan speech.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to preempt.
You're jumping ahead on the lightning round, huh?
Yeah.
Go for it.
Lightning round, because your team gave me the three questions that you want to ask. So, of course, they are on my mind. But so one of the things, Roger, is that. We had, as I think about what it was that Reagan did in June 8th of 1982, he delivered this speech to, Westminster, which basically is his Ballots Over Bullets. And it's the speech in which he advocated the establishment of the National Endowment for Democracy. And so I joined and went onto the board of, what actually played a role in naming the International Republican Institute. It was first called the National Republican Institute for International Affairs, NRIIA. So Dick Lubber and I were at a board meeting, and I just proposed. I looked on a napkin. It was sort of like Art Laffer, the napkin, and Luger and I were sitting there. I said, well, what is this? This is International, it's Republican Institute. So I said, IRI. So I raised my hand because people couldn't say the name of it. So I said, I propose, Mr. Chairman, that we change the name from the National Republican Institute for International Affairs to the International Republican Institute. Everybody said yes, so we named it. That's how we named the IRI. I remember that meeting very vividly, and we all got a good chuckle out of that. But that was part of the vision that Ronald Reagan put forward, establishing the National Democratic Institute, the Chambers of Commerce, organized labor, all part of the overall umbrella of the National Endowment for Democracy, which had as its goal, and the things he pointed out in that speech were so important, what Reagan called for was fostering the infrastructure of democracy. Yep. And we recognize that the real work takes place between elections. And I always like to say, one election a democracy does not make. We've learned that in more than a few countries. And frankly, Hamas's election in Gaza is a perfect example of that. It took place in 2005, 2006, and it hasn't happened since. So the thing that I think is really important to recognize here is that this was an idea that Ronald Reagan had that was outlined in that famous speech, June 8th of 1982, and I wanted to build it. So in 2005, my Democratic colleague, David Price, and I came together, and we established something, a commission in the Congress called the House Democracy Partnership, which is really an offspring of the National Endowment for Democracy that Ronald Reagan put there. The argument, and you can relate to this, Roger, as well as anyone, and that is recognizing that the body that is closest to the people throughout the world are the parliaments. Even if they're not directly elected, they somehow have ties to constituencies for the most part. And so, you know this from having gone on congressional delegations and all, members of Congress would tend to go into countries and they would fly in and meet with prime ministers and presidents and the executive leaders. So we said that strengthening the parliaments in new and reemerging democracies will do more to help promote political pluralism, the rule of law, democratic institutions than most anything. And so,
and you travel the world. You and Congressman Price travel the world with this. I mean, really reinforcing freedom and kind of transition of power, and of course elections and the like.
Right. Well, what we did was, and I used to quip. I said we'd shared the experience of the United States Congress with these parliaments and the new and reemerging democracies, and we'd done it. Now it's higher. We've done it in by 21 different countries all over the world. And I used to quip that if they saw the United States Congress in operation, they may want to go back to totalitarianism in their countries. But the fact of the matter is, we actually did have our experiment. And so what we did, Roger, is we would go in and share the committee structure that we had. In fact, in Afghanistan, the parliament in Afghanistan is basically set up with very similar to the structure that we have in the House of Representatives. And, you know, in some ways, I felt like a founding father being there. I remembered that as we go back a decade to the uprising in the Arab world, what was sometimes called the Arab Spring, I remember being in Tunisia and helping them put their constitution together as they were look at changes. And obviously, things have not gone perfectly. We all know it's a constant work in progress. Ronald Reagan famously said we're, one generation away from extinction. And so, it is a struggle. And then I always like to say, too, as I look at people in Egypt, we declared independence in 1776, but I always like to point to the fact that it was March of 1789 that our government was actually put into place. So it took a long time to make it happen.
Time.
So many countries that are struggling today that we've worked on are still struggling, and they have fits and starts.
Yeah, I think that's a sound point, and we have to have the patience. The 1776 to 1789 point is one that is not made enough, and the infrastructure, what Reagan spoke about at Westminster, which you of course added to that infrastructure with the caucus that you co-led, adds to that infrastructure, and in terms of parliamentary exchanges. And the like, I mean, that's just the essential work. And it's one that is never finished, right? I mean, this is constant engagement is required. And we as a country, I think, and our leaders can't give up on that. And that's where I feel like the difference when I remember you leading in the U.S. Congress and where we are today is that so many people are pessimistic about our own democracy at home. They don't feel that there's a role for the United States to lead, you know, and obviously Reagan was pivotal in his day when they were the doubters and then the declinists, and his response was not to indulge that thinking, but actually to counter it with force. And you did the same in your time.
Peace through strength.
And then, you know, the Reagan doctrine in terms of advancing, you know, whether it be the Afghans and of course, you know, with Westminster. I mean, all these are all the necessary pieces. I'm curious, though. I mean, you have love listening to you about your tenure, about what you're doing now. One of the things I always enjoyed also talking with you with David Dreyer, former congressman from California and longtime chair of the Rules Committee. So you had this wonderful personal relationship with President Reagan. Did you ever talk freedom and democracy with him?
I did, and let me just say at the outset from what you were mentioning earlier about this whole notion of the promotion and expansion of democracy. And you mentioned, Roger, this kind of pessimism that is there. I'm reminded in 2008, I went with Nancy Pelosi to the 60th anniversary of the establishment of the State of Israel. And I remember sitting with Ehud Barak, who'd been the prime minister at that point. He was the defense minister. And I said to him, because of my training with Reagan, I said, I'm an optimist. And Ehud Barak looked to me and he said, young man, a pessimist is an optimist with experience. And I was struck by that, but I told him that I did not want to let that experience that we all gain with time slip into pessimism. And I'm reminded that, you know, Ronald Reagan's wonderful statue that's in the great rotunda of the Capitol, Roger, and I know you've seen it many times, and I was there. My colleague Dan Lundgren was involved, and he was heading the administration committee. I remember we were working back on it then, and the front of it has Ronald Reagan's name, and on either side, it's one side has the state of the seal of the state of California, the other side the seal of the United States of America. Not many people get to see the three quotes that are actually on the back of the statue. And unfortunately, it is on the back and it's against the wall. So I encourage anyone who goes into the Great Rotunda of the Capitol to crawl around and look and look at the three quotes there. They're very, very simple. The quotes that were from Ronald Reagan is, America's best days are yet to come. Our proudest moments are yet to be. Our most glorious achievements are just ahead. And so I always try to hang tough with that. And then if I can tell the story that I think one of my very favorite stories about Reagan's sense of hope and optimism for the future beyond those three quotes, and you'll recall this story that I told, and this is actually true, and it's the first time that I heard it. We all know that there were really difficult times in the early part of his presidency economically for the American people, because we had, you know, we had economic policy. We had, I mean, when I was elected and Ronald Reagan was elected, interest rates were well into double digit. I mean, when I got bought my place on Capitol Hill, my interest rate was 16% for the place that I bought. I didn't rent because my family's business was real estate. And my dad said, we don't pay rent, we collect it. So he made me buy a place, which I'm glad I did ultimately. So I bought a place on Capitol Hill right next door to Mitch McConnell and Elaine Chao, interestingly enough, on C Street Northeast and right by the Senate, by the Hart Building. And then we had unemployment that was well into double digits, and we had inflation still sky high. So all of these numbers, indicators, were very bad. And in August of 1982, there was a party right up the hill from where I'm sitting here in Bel Air. And a guy called Henry Singleton, who was the head of Teledyne, had this party. And there were about 20 people gathered, and the Reagans were going to be there on this afternoon. And everybody was anguishing over unemployment, interest rates, inflation, you know, all of these bad economic indicators. And Nancy and Ronald Reagan came to the gathering. And so everybody, you know, we had a nice time there. So President Reagan stood up. So, you know, somebody asked me the other day how I'm feeling. And I said, I've never been better. Well, everybody looked at each other like, you know, what's wrong with this guy? And Reagan proceeded to tell this story about this caravan of farm animals being driven through a countryside. And there's this awful accident, animals screwing all over the highway. Well, the sheriff comes roaring up and he gets out of his car and he sees this horse lying on the side of the road, two broken legs, frothing at the mouth. So he takes his gun out, puts it to the horse's head, puts him out of his misery. And then he sees another animal, actually it's a dog, and the dog is there and he's shaking like there's no tomorrow. So he takes his gun, puts the dog out of his misery. And then he sees the driver of one of those vehicles. He had blood running down his face, both legs broken. And the sheriff looked to the driver and said, "And how are you feeling?" "I've never been better." And it's instructive of how Ronald Reagan was able, Roger, to take on these issues and continue to be positive and upbeat.
And ultimately on the economic issues, he prevailed, obviously, relied on you and your other colleagues in the Congress to support him. And we
the federal treasury with the economic policies that he put into place.
We only have a couple minutes left where David Dreier, the former chairman of the House Rules Committee and senior Republican on that committee for over a decade and member of the House from California. Before we go to lightning round, I do want to ask you to share a little bit about a piece of art that's over your right shoulder. We'll show it on the screen for our viewers. It's from President Reagan's birthday party, I think in 1994, if I have it right. But tell them about that.
So, well, first, let me just say that 5 years ago, and we're recording this in November of 2023, 5 years ago, I had, other than the death of my parents, the worst thing I had my home in Malibu burned to the ground in the Woolsey fire. This is the fifth anniversary of that fire. And I had notes from President Reagan. I remembered it from his 85th birthday. There was a little atlas that I had. I remembered it on the table and all kinds of other things from heads of state and people all over. Anyway, everything. I had Thomas Jefferson's manuals for the whole 32 years that I was there. But very fortunately, I have this apartment, and over my shoulder here is the napkin that was at the table. This was February 3rd, you'll see on there. It's kind of hard to see, but February 3rd, 1994. And I sat with this iconic artist called Peter Max. And not everyone knows who he is. He was an artist, famous artist in the 1980s. And he drew this drawing. It was this woman who was the love of his life. And he inscribed it. I just met him. He said, like, "For David, with love, Peter." And I'd never seen him before, never seen him since. But anyway, it was a very, very, very nice thing. So I got it framed because it's an original Peter Max that I've got. But the thing about that speech was, it was the last speech, Roger, that Ronald Reagan delivered before he wrote the letter to the American people that he had Alzheimer's. And the thing I remember, and you'll recall that David Gergen had worked for President Reagan and then went to work kind of personally for Bill Clinton later. And so Reagan was getting ready to deliver the speech, and he got up and he kind of wavered a bit, and everybody gasped. I mean, Margaret Thatcher was at that dinner. It was a big Republican dinner that was held in Washington, and he got up and people were concerned about him and all. He got to the lectern and he looked out and he said, "You know, yesterday they flew the plane in and we circled the White House, and I looked down and there was everything just the way I remembered it. The Rose Garden, the South Lawn, David Gergen." And I mean, he gave a great speech after that. And it's so memorable because that was the last public speech that he delivered before he wrote that letter.
I've heard others refer to that event and that speech and how meaningful it was because he spoke to the American people through his speeches, right? He connected the American people and advanced his policy, his presidency through the speeches. And so for the last one to be a good one, I know it means a lot to those who saw him up close and worked in his administration, or in your case, in the political branch adjacent to his administration. Let's go to the lightning round. You've given us your favorite Reagan speech, the Westminster Address in June of 1982. David Dreier, do you have a favorite Reagan quote? You've thrown a few, maybe half a dozen out during the course of this conversation, one you want to mention, and your favorite Reagan book.
Appropriate to you, obviously, in all the arsenals of the world, no weapon is so powerful than the moral courage of free men and women. So that's obviously a powerful one.
First inaugural, we love that one.
Yep. But the thing is that in that speech, the Westminster speech, is something that to me is very instructive today. as we're dealing with a lot of discomfort. I want to bring Reagan back, and I kind of moved beyond Reagan. If you go back 10 years, I said we need to move beyond it. But frankly, in the last 8 years, I have just said that we need to focus on it. So this line is in that speech, the Westminster speech, and he was talking about the Soviets. But think about this today. Self-delusion in the face of unpleasant facts is folly. If that isn't as instructive today as it was back when Ronald Reagan stated that, I don't know what is. And that's what we as Republicans need to think about, too, as we proceed. My favorite book is Lou Cannon's Ronald Reagan, Role of a Lifetime. And by the way, I need to thank you, Roger. You hosted the 40th anniversary of the class, the 54 of us who were elected, and we had like 23, 24 of us. Many of course, passed away. A group of us were in our 20s then, and so it was great to do that.
Well, that was an honor, and one of the purposes of us being here in D.C., got to engage with you and your colleagues who did so much, and in your case, I mean, continue to do so much for our country. Looking forward to seeing that memorial on the nation's mall, and look forward to having you back in the Capitol.
Of 2028 is when we're hoping to dedicate it.
Well, let's plan on having a side event over here at the Reagan Institute at the time of dedication.
We'll do it. We'll do it, Roger. We'll be together many times between now and then.
Look forward to it. Thank you so much. Take care.
Thanks. Thanks so much, Roger.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Reaganism. New episodes premiere weekly every Monday on YouTube and all podcast streaming platforms. If you like this episode, be sure to let us know and share with a friend.